Recorded live in downtown Newtown and Vancouver, British Columbia, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Everybody to season 1, episode 17 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dan Slevin, and with me in Wellington is Fairfax film reviewer Graham Tuckett. Hello, Graham.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
Very well. It's a pleasure to have you here. And in Vancouver, Canada, Kaylee Carruthers.
Yes, hi.
Now, we've already established before we went to air that you are not going to be as loud and as boisterous as you perhaps might normally be. So perhaps you could paint a word picture for our listeners about the arrangement that you are in at the moment.
Well, it's 10:45 at night on Wednesday here in Vancouver, British Columbia. I am in my brother and his lovely wife's apartment, and my niece is next door. So I'm just trying not to wake the baby.
Yeah, and your niece is 2, is that right?
Just turned 2.
Just turned 2. Oh, that's a good age. That's a good age for waking up and interrupting podcasts, I would imagine. So yes, we need to be very careful. How has your week been, Kaylee?
My week's been really exciting. The Vancouver Film Festival wrapped up last Friday, although they had some extra days of screenings, but I finished my VIF experience with the closing night film of Whiplash, and I'm so glad I did. We will get into that shortly. And today I saw 2 films. I went and watched The Judge, which, if anyone saw my tweet, will already sort of know the flavor of my opinion of it.
Oh, we're coming to that.
And I just came back from Gone Girl, which was much, much better.
So. All right. Well, we'll be discussing Gone Girl when we get to the top fives a little bit later on, and we'll give you an opportunity to feed in your opinion there. On today's program, in addition to a little bit more detail about your Vancouver International Film Festival experiences, the three of us. I'm going to collaborate on a review of Robert Downey Jr. In The Judge with Robert Duvall. And Graham and I, we're going to count the laughs in Let's Be Cops, which probably will be a fairly short conversation, I would imagine.
That was it, wasn't it?
So all of that, plus the usual, you know, news, stats, opinion, etc. But Kaylee, do you have the mailbag in front of you?
Yes, I do. And speaking of Let's Be Cops, Darren Bevan, also known as GeekBoy73 on Twitter, 2-word review, Let's Not. Squandered premise and potential, a script that needed laughs, not screeching.
No, good. Yeah, good call, Darren. We may go into more detail a little bit later on.
I think they've pretty much summed it up, actually. It's one of those films you really do. How much time do you really want to spend talking about? But we can. We will eviscerate it audibly.
Fred Thompson sends his 2-word review for Walk Among the Tombstones, dark and disturbing, very visceral, very realistic, with Neeson providing the usual gravitas.
That's what he does.
Yep.
That and a chest.
Liam Neeson, I don't think of gravitas, I think of like, I don't know, Taken.
The only time the Dominion Post ever called me up to growl me about something I wrote and tell me why they wouldn't be printing it was when I tried to describe Liam Neeson as a veteran granny dampener. I actually got like a phone call from the sub-editor going, is this a typo or are you trying to be that offensive? And I was like, sort. It was good. I thought it was one of those jokes, if you got it, you wouldn't be offended by it, and the people who would be offended by it wouldn't get it, but no.
Talking of sub-editors, I was in New Plymouth this weekend, and of course, as Fairfax movie reviewer, you are syndicated through the nation.
I contribute a great deal of unpaid labour, is what you mean. Yes.
The Taranaki Daily News is a Fairfax paper, and yep. It had one of yours in there. I think your review of The Judge was in there. And also James Crute's review of Let's Be Cops.
Right.
But for some reason, the sub-editor had assigned 5 stars. To both of them.
Oh, brilliant. They'll sell out New Plymouth because nobody would have actually read the text, during which I said I was really underwhelmed with the judge, and I imagine James Crute didn't like Let's Be Cops at all either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's almost as if somebody just decided.
There'll be a spike in the emissions in Taranaki.
Something else from the mailbag. I noticed as we were, you know, because you always, you know, in Twitter you're always searching for your own name. Or the name of the podcast that you produce.
I don't twit much, but I should actually get back into it. I went as far as getting the handle, basically, so I couldn't be impersonated.
It's a very good call. There's a Twitter account called Wellington_TNG which somebody attempts to update Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, I was wondering what TNG stood for. Okay,
Star Trek The Next Generation as per Wellington, and periodically some comment about the news will appear on there. So here we go. Wellington TNG. Barclay is invited as a guest holodeck reviewer on Rancho podcast, so that's obviously a good sign. And David Cunliffe throws his support in for Picard as captain. So
it's my favourite tweet this week. I love
That's somebody's favourite tweet that week. Barclay was a character in
Star Trek The Next Generation.
I'm shedding geek cred like as I sit here, aren't I?
Exactly. Well,
I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I was never a massive Star Trek fan. Love the movies. Love the movies. Love the Shat. Huge fan of the Shat.
Is there anybody who is both? Is there anybody who is a Star Wars and a Star Trek fan?
I thought everybody else who was a Star Trek fan was also a Star Wars fan.
There's a line in the sand there, I think, and people, you know, they're obsessive about one and not the other.
My happiest memory of Star Trek, this is a wild diversion, but my happiest memory of Star Trek, ever was back in the day when I was like a nightclubby little person. I mean, staggering back up the hill with associated flatmates and hangers-on to this massive, great barn of a place we all shared in Mount Victoria. Not all the way, we're about 19 years old now. And getting in at about, I don't know, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning and sort of lighting cigarettes and getting food and orange juice and like cold takeaways. And turning on the TV and Star Trek would be on. And it would be followed by The Muppet Show. So from like 7:30 till about 9:30, when you're all, everything had completely worn off and you were time to go to bed and fall asleep, there would be Star Trek followed by The Muppets. And I just have such fond memories of those two shows in obviously wildly misspent youth.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Kayleigh, back to the mailbag.
Sorry, that was a huge diversion.
And it was only mildly self-indulgent as well.
Oh, come on. I was trying.
It was lovely. We got some like chatty tweets from Fred Thompson as well. Is it just me or 22 minutes 32 seconds of ads/trailers before a film too much, especially before Gone Girl of 2 hours and 29 minutes running time?
There are a lot more ads than there used to be.
Yeah.
And
this brings me to an interesting point of something that happened to me today. For the second visit in a row to the big corporate cinemas here in Vancouver, there was an issue which made me have to leave the cinema, find the 12-year-old working behind the candy bar, tell them it wasn't working. So all the ads and trailers ran when I went to see The Judge today.
Yeah.
And then the movie didn't start. So we were just sitting there, waiting in the dark.
I love the fact that you finally got old enough to think that the people who work behind the candy bar are 12-year-olds.
They're so tiny.
I know.
But yes, 22 minutes. When I was in the States 2 years ago, I couldn't believe how long the pre-show entertainment was.
Yeah.
And in fact, that there was even pre-show entertainment that was running on the screen before the scheduled start time, which is when the actual ads would start. So let's say, you know, a movie is supposed to start at 6:15. You get there at 6:05 and you're sitting there and they play 10 minutes of promo for the new season of Homeland on the screen. And then they start running ads.
It's pretty much, I'm just guessing it's the only advertising they can sell anymore, is the stuff that's basically tied in with the studio that also has shares in the multiplex.
Well, I don't know. If you go to readings here in Wellington now, I mean, apart from there's a lot of advertising for stuff that's for them, for their gold class and what have you. And then there's the steer and beer, which is the worst ad.
Yeah.
And the loudest,
but that is their tenant.
That's right. But also, at a certain time of year, you'll find that there's a lot of advertising for tertiary education institutions to encourage people to, because they've always got budget to throw around, and no one ever got fired for spending too little on advertising when you're a university. So there's always a little bit of that going on. And Sky advertise an enormous amount on...
That's true. But I mean, compared to sort of, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago, the amount of advertising that used to be pre-internet that would screen... I mean, obviously TV for some reason doesn't seem to have suffered for it in the way that newspapers and I'm guessing cinema chains have.
That's
hence
right.
Now more trailers because there's simply less commercial advertising, but they still insist on having 15 minutes of something before the bloody movie starts.
I've worked for two cinemas in my time who, when they launched, they made a very big point about the fact that they did not have any commercial advertising before the film. It was there would be two movie trailers, so 4 minutes, and then boom, they'd be into it. And both of those cinemas ended up caving and taking whatever they got offered.
If you've got an income stream and you're in business, you generally find yourself having to exploit that income stream if possible.
Yeah, no matter how proudly you proclaimed your innocence beforehand.
But personally, I like trailers. As long as the trailer doesn't actually, as long as it's not an encapsulation of everything that's going to happen in the movie, which too often trailers are, or the trailer that has sort of the big jump or the big laugh included, which often that's the case. But I like sitting down and going, oh, great, I'll be tearing that to shreds in 3 months' time.
Movie trailers for me are they're works of art in and of themselves. And
can be,
And so, yeah, they are. They are entertaining. So I don't really have a problem with that. And, but these things, when you know you're trying to watch a film and get home before the last bus or get out before the last bus goes, you know, you're trying to time your life, then have 22 minutes is a long time.
Something like Gone Girl, which seemed to be over half an hour before it was actually over and felt like an awfully, awfully long film. 15 minutes of trailers before that would have driven me spare. Luckily, indeed. I saw it at a little art house that had just the usual couple. So,
how many minutes did you have to put up with before the whole place went dark?
I can't remember.
That's okay. I won't pin
my nachos because I decided to try the nachos because I've never had nachos at a cinema before.
Nachos.
And I know someone who like hates them and said the most disgusting thing ever. And they pretty much were.
What nachos per se or just cinema nachos?
This is another thing. Hot food in cinemas, no. Let's say no. Just say no to hot food in cinemas.
It wasn't even hot. It was tepid.
It sounds like you had a great experience, and we'll come to the rest of it. Shortly.
Tepid plastic nachos in a darkened cinema. It's like it's Dante, isn't it?
All right, so it's time to move on to what people have been seeing. What the tale of the tape, as they say, and I guess you know what is the New Zealand top five? Whether they've been tepid nachoing or not.
What is the New Zealand top five? I wouldn't have the faintest idea.
I gave you the piece of paper down there.
Yeah, it says
just
keep going. It says NZ top five.
Yes, yes. I'll give you more than that piece of paper. Keep going.
Oh, okay.
So I'm glad I now have my two-word review for the judge. Number five, down from three, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yay.
Doing good business.
Love that film.
In at number four, up from five, The Box Trolls.
That's good, based purely on the amount of promotion that it got from me last week after having seen it.
I haven't seen it. I might shout myself.
It's really good.
As good as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
I haven't seen that, so I can't tell you. But were you a Paranorman fan? Did you enjoy
that? Oh, yeah, I love Paranorman.
Okay, well, it's better than
and
that.
And Coraline as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's better than both.
Coraline's a masterpiece.
Well, this is really good.
I think. Yeah, okay. So I was
in at number three.
Yeah.
Oh, in at number three, Let's Be Cops, and I'm definitely looking forward to hearing your reviews about it, because even when it was in the top five in other countries, I remember you, Dan, just...
We'll save it for after the news, don't worry.
Okay.
Sitting steady at number two, Gone Girl, and in the number one position again, The Maze Runner.
Which is, I think this
is the Maze Runner number one in the country.
Still number one. Jesus Gone Girl, unlike everywhere else in the world, Gone Girl not number one here in New Zealand. But I think that's a symptom of school holiday syndrome, I think.
That would make sense. I mean, the Maze Runner's got a huge teen following
hasn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I would say, I mean, Gone Girl was day and date everywhere in the world, same weekend. And it's only New Zealand that has school holidays.
So we could put good money next week that
should be yeah. pushed up. Okay, so in Australia, talking of Across the Ditch and our cousins over there, down one at number five, The Maze Runner. Straight in at number four, The Judge, Robert Downey Jr. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on. Dracula Untold, down one at three.
Surprisingly enjoyable film.
Right, again, one that I haven't seen. Thanks. It's a good job you're here to help us out with this stuff. Annabelle, the horror film, which is from the Conjuring
franchise. Supposed to be a prequel to the Conjuring.
Prequel to the Conjuring.
Yeah, I managed to dodge the Conjuring
They played a trailer for it last night in front of Let's Be Cops, and this is, you know, without having seen the film, I can't vouch for its frighteningness or its jumpiness or whatever. But I would say that if I found a doll like that in my luggage when I moved into a house, I would not be going, "Oh, there's a space for that on that shelf. It fits perfectly." I would be going, "Set that thing on fire before you've even started." It would be a very short film if it was in
my
house.
Give it to a child you don't like. It's just an awful, awful looking thing.
Exactly.
It's like the people in horror movies have never seen horror movies. You know, it's that great meta thing that needs to happen. It's like...
Well, isn't that what Scary Movie was, though? Scary Movie was all about people who...
Cabin in the Woods talks about it really nicely as well. Yeah. But I think if you're writing a horror movie, you have to write it in the knowledge that the people in your horror movie have seen horror movies.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And number one in Australia is Gone Girl.
Nice.
In the US, we have The Judge at number five, Annabelle at number four, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, which I think seems like a very interesting take on the children's book. Number three.
Yeah, it's,
I'm looking forward to that.
It's got a huge following.
I saw Letterman talking about it a couple of nights ago, and I saw a clip and just went, I love the look of that. Sorry, there must be
Dracula something. Dracula Untold is at number two, and Gone Girl is in the number one position.
Mm-hmm. Which I think it says a lot for the fact that a movie that isn't a sequel, that isn't based on a franchise, it is based on a book, so it has come from something, but it is at the very least, you know, an original piece of work by a director who not everybody sort of warms to.
Also, I think it's a triumph of marketing. I think it's just somehow it's got a brilliant marketing campaign, and it's managing, maybe it's piggybacking on whatever dramatic cred Ben Affleck picked up from Argo or something, but I can't understand the interest in seeing this depressing 2.5 hour film. Mm-hmm. Like if Zodiac tanked at the box office, which it effectively did, why the interest in this one?
Oh, because this is the battle of the sexes, and everybody's interested in
it. So it's being marketed as the anti-date film, so which of course makes it a date film.
That's right. Yeah, or maybe not a first date film, and maybe not a last date film.
Sort of a catching up with the ex film, perhaps.
Kaylee, you saw it today when they finally got around to switching it on, and I know that when we reviewed it here a couple of weeks ago,
Gone Girl was fine. It was the judge that they.
It was the judge you saw today. Wasn't it?
I was the judge today. Okay, yeah. But Gone Girl, you have seen during the week.
Oh, I saw Gone Girl this evening. I saw two films today. So
it's nighttime for you. I forget. Yes. Yeah. All right. Yes. Well, now what I'm trying to do is throw the ball, pass the ball to you. The Gone Girl ball is going spinning out through the backs, and you get to now run towards the try line with it.
In your pajamas.
It's a metaphor. Bear with me.
Is that a metaphor, like, or is that an analogy? I don't. I can never remember the difference.
Or is it an aphorism? I don't know.
No, it's not an aphorism.
No, it's not an aphorism. Kaylee, tell us, what did you think of Gone Girl?
I enjoyed it because, as you know, with our discussion with like Encendies and what was the other one he did recently?
Prisoner was one of his. You're talking about Denis Villeneuve.
Yes, thank you. I like the sort of like whodunit mystery movies that sort of drag you along. I like it. Like, I'm really entertained by those. So I enjoyed Gone Girl because it just sort of kept like upping the crazy, ridiculous ante.
Yeah.
So, but to be fair, I watched The Judge earlier today. So Gone Girl was like brilliant. But I also really like David Fincher's work. Mm. It felt more like his television work than something really cinematic. But I did enjoy it. And I thought the casting was great and the music was great. And I enjoyed the ride.
I was going to say, what's his television work? But of course, he did the first couple of episodes of House of Cards, didn't he?
And basically set the entire tone for that as executive producer.
So everything in it was Brown and Grey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And under Lit from Beneath and all that all that stuff that he does that he does so well.
Yeah.
I've always found Fincher. I mean, I love Fincher as I enjoy his work. I think he's got a visual wit. He's got a wonderful sense of percussive editing. The opening credits for Gone Girl were absolutely brilliant, and it would be really hard to actually pin down like to a non film reviewer audience exactly what about them was so effective, but they were really, really good.
I was on the wireless last week, having a rave to whoever listens to that station, and going, and I said, I think it's the closest thing we've got to a Kubrick today is David Fincher.
Yeah,
just the care and the craft, and he's also, as Kubrick was, he's either notorious or greatly revered for getting 40, 50, 60, 70 takes until he figures the actor has absolutely emotionally nailed what he wanted them to nail.
But at the same time,
he makes actors look good.
Yeah, you know? But at the same time, there's something kind of cold. About him.
There's a chilliness about him.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
But he shoots chilly films. I mean, he's never going to make Let's Be Cops 2, is he?
No, but...
I wish he would, though. That would be so much fun.
Well, I remember saying, reviewing Girl with the Dragon Tattoo on the radio a few years ago and saying, I just want Fincher to make all the commercial films. Like, he would elevate all the pulp.
Well, all the commercial. All the drama and all the horror, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he got a decent performance out of Brad Pitt, which no one's ever done before or since, back with Seven. He made Ben Affleck look like a dramatic actor, which I don't think will ever happen again. This is only directors can get great performers out of actors, even if it does take, I mean, you have to shoot 100 takes. And it's just, as a visual stylist, he's one of the few people working today that I would put money on Dan or you, Kaylee, or myself to be able to spot the Fincher film.
Hmm.
If somebody chopped the credits off, we'd still say, no, that was one of his, you can tell.
Yeah.
There's a pace and a time and a placement and a palette that is very signature him.
How did you feel, Kaylee, about the gender politics? Because that's obviously the one area of that film that has thousands and thousands of words have been expended upon it. There are theses being written about it. Did it make you uncomfortable, or did you feel like it was just kind of a pulp novel with, you know,
pretensions?
I thought it was pretty uncomfortable. Ben Affleck has a line in the film pretty early on, although who knows where the midpoint is, it's so long. He says, "I'm just tired of being controlled by women," and it's like, whoa, Ben Affleck. Tone it down.
I think there was something in there that I don't think anybody else has pointed out in the reviews that I've read or the learned discussions about it. And there's at a very early point in the film, Ben Affleck goes to his sister's bar in the morning to visit her, and she's wearing a T-shirt with a squirrel on it, and the T-shirt says, protect your nuts, basically.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, okay, there's the subtext for this film.
It's funny,
right?
I also noticed that T-shirt and went, somebody actually made the directorial decision
to put that T-shirt on someone.
That was the T-shirt, and those were the words you'd be reading through the entire
exactly, and therefore, much as it, I would love to say that the film is kind of evenly balanced, and both parties are pretty noxious individuals, and they both lie and cheat and what have you.
Yep.
In the end, it does fall pretty sympathetically on Ben Affleck's character's shoulders, doesn't it?
I mean, it is. I mean, there are gender politics in it, but what I got from it is you were dealing with a sociopath. Mm. It's about mental instability, you know, and there's several characters in this film where they're either very clearly off or you're second guessing what you're hearing or what's going on. So, but I mean, obviously gender plays a big role in it because of Rosamund Pike's character and, you know, Ben Affleck is the way his character develops and the way you're questioning his motives and stuff.
You know what I love is when people on Twitter decide that because Glenn Close played a bunny boiler in Fatal Attraction in 1987 and Rosamund Pike plays a sociopath in this film, that indicates some kind of trend towards Hollywood's and treatment of women.
And a mere 27 years later.
Yeah, you know, it's like, yeah. You know, come on. I mean, there are more recent examples that you could draw on, but it's like the laziest of, Hollywood women hating.
Right.
And Adrian Lyne, who made Fatal Attraction, really did hate women.
I always get Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct confused. Like those two, I can never remember which one of those two films is which.
Oh, they both...
they've both got the Michael Douglas, haven't they?
Yeah.
They've both got the Douglas factor. Yeah. Right, that's why I always confuse them. And I can still never remember which is the one with Sharon Stone and the ice pick and which is the one with Glenn Close and the saucepan.
Let's look at the poems now and what they've been going to see at the Flicks at number 5, Dracula Untold, which is country of origin here on the UK box office says USA, but it's full of Brit actors, so I can totally understand.
It's shot in Ireland. It's got Bill Nighy. Yeah. No, not Bill Nighy. No, it is Bill Nighy.
Charles Dance.
The other Bill Nighy. Charles Dance. Yeah.
Yeah. And riding on the coattails of Game of Thrones pretty thoroughly. Number 4, and I love this about Britain. Their alternative content just goes bang straight at number 10. It was the Billy Elliot, the musical live performance made £1 million 2 weeks ago. Number 4, One Direction, Where We Are, the concert film.
Fantastic.
Made a million quid as well. Annabelle, right. We've talked about number 3. Maze Runner at number 2 and Gone Girl at number 1 in the UK.
Maze Runner actually feels surprisingly Anglophile as well. It didn't feel like an American film to me. It felt very much almost like a post-apocalyptic UK as much as it did America. I mean, there was a whiff of an English accent in some of the leads or something, but I felt like I was watching something. It was like, it was quite small scale as well. Well, I guess that implies that you come from a cold, damp little island like England. Lots of grey concrete. Well, depressed teenagers.
You or I, of course, are fully entitled to comment.
Oh, yeah, no, we're allowed to slag off England because we're Pomgolians, yes.
Indeed. All right, Kayleigh, we'll come back to you now because you have had a pretty good week at the Vancouver International Film Festival. What have your highlights been for? I know the last time you were on the show, you were enthusiastic about what you were going to see. Did those films measure up?
Definitely, yeah. It was a fantastic closing week / my first full week at VIFF. Of course, made better by the fact that I received 3 free tickets, one for doing a survey while I was waiting in line, because what else are you going to do? Huh. And 2 through Twitter. So I got 3 free tickets.
Nice.
So,
boom. Yeah. And there's no allocated seating at VIFF, is that right? It's pretty common in festivals overseas. There's no allocated seating. You do your wait in line.
Nice.
Yeah, so I would arrive about 30 to 45 minutes beforehand.
Yeah.
Depending on the film and how.
God, it's such an incentive to turn up on bloody time, isn't it? No allocated seating.
Yeah. Some people are still late, but it's understandable for the evening sessions when people are coming in between films because it is quite close. Because at VIFF, every film is introduced and then you have some trailers at the start, or I guess sponsorship sort of more bumpers, and then the film starts. So I could have made it, but I actually missed out on my final film, which was The Incident, which is a sort of sci-fi Mexican film, which I actually was really looking forward to seeing, but it was also at 11:30 p.m. and I was just like, I just can't do it. I'm gonna fall asleep.
Is that based on a novel, The Incident?
It doesn't say in the notes if it is. Okay. I'm just looking at the VIFF booklet.
If it is, I've read it, but I can't remember whether it was sci-fi or not. But then it's such a generic title that it could be the name of 5 different books, couldn't it?
True. Mm. Like the devil.
Sure.
But the closing night film for VIFF was Whiplash, which I was definitely looking forward to and totally delivered.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. Really intense.
I've seen it. Yeah, I got a preview of it a couple of weeks back.
God damn it.
Sorry,
Kayleigh, carry on. Yeah. I'm just going to throttle Graham in the corner while you're talking.
Because I walked in expecting Fame, and it's not. It's Black Swan. It's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. It was, and J.K. Simmons, right?
I know. Dan's favourite actor in that film. He hasn't seen it either.
Incredible. I've never seen him.
Look, how much money would you bet against J.K. Simmons getting an Academy Award Best Supporting Nomination for that? Like, he's just got a lock on it, surely. Like, he's not going to not get an Academy Award Best Supporting Actor nomination for that.
Bold claim, Graham. Bold claim, considering a lot of the big guns haven't come out yet.
Yep. Still, I'll put a six pack of whatever beer you nominate.
All right, done.
On that right now.
Okay.
Okay.
I will put a six pack down for Steve Carell though for Foxcatcher if he doesn't get a nomination for best actor or.
Okay.
Yeah, he would be leading actor in Foxcatcher. Incredible. Nice. Wow. Incredible.
He's wonderful when he straightens up, isn't he, Steve Carell? I mean, he's a great comedian, but him and Little Miss Sunshine, I adore him in that.
Oh, God, I hate that film so much.
What?
Little Miss Sunshine, I hate that film so much.
Are you the one? Are you the only person in the world that doesn't like Little Miss Sunshine?
I have a totally irrational hatred for that film.
I loathe Gone Girl, by the way. So, I mean, I'm pretty much out of a limb with that as well. So,
all right. So back to Vancouver.
Yep.
One I was really looking forward to that I saw half of and then fell asleep because it was an 11:30 screening. Was A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. It's an Iranian film about a young Iranian woman who is a vampire. And it was awesome.
Who is a vampire?
Black and white.
That rocks my world.
Bring on the feminist Iranian vampire bloody genre. Oh, more of that.
Yeah,
did you say it's in black and white as well?
Yeah, it's black and white.
Oh,
it's
God.
It's got like hints of almost like Bollywood. It's got a little bit of like noir, a little bit of B movie in it. It was beautiful, but that was my five film day and it was my fifth film.
Oh, it's like somebody's gone, there's this guy in New Zealand, let's make a film just for him. Really black and white Bollywood vampire Iranian
feminist
with feminist overtones.
Bring it.
I'm staying alive for another 6 months just to see that. Awesome.
It's
thank
great.
You.
I know it's been confirmed for Abu Dhabi Film Festival, so I'm hoping it does travel around some more.
Abu Dhabi.
I need to see it in the daylight so I can watch it all over again. It was just brilliant.
I would be very surprised if Mad Men Entertainment doesn't pick that up. It seems to be right up their alley. I would have thought so.
Yeah.
I think we need to start like a Cabin in the Woods-esque petition.
I was going to say, like, once you put the bloody as soon as you say vampire, somebody's going to screen it.
A campaign. Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah. Out of Australia, I saw The Infinite Man, which was good, quite funny, about a sort of desperate fellow that is trying to save his marriage. So he creates a time machine that is supposed to like transport you back to a moment in your life. So he built it so you can remember a happy moment, but he ends up using it to try and save his marriage and replicates himself several times in several other universes, but all within this very small sort of abandoned motel type place in the middle of the desert.
Wow.
So it's very charming and quite funny.
So this is like, what was that great low budget sci-fi with all those identical men crawling out of that freezer?
Primer.
I was going to say, it says like Primer is a rom-com.
And one that I was really intrigued by and decided to go to and then sort of felt nauseous the rest of the day was Heaven Knows What, which was absolutely a punch to the gut, but so, so good.
Yeah.
It's based on the true story of a young woman, and it's part documentary, part dramatization, and she is a heroin addict and she's living on the streets with her sort of emotionally abusive boyfriend, and it's just sort of like a week in their life, and it is so raw and just like so, like, they don't, it's not glamorized, it's not pretty in any way, it's just right there,
and they don't look like Heath Ledger and Naomi Watts or anything. It's just
It was a great experience. Yeah, it was an amazing watch, but I did feel very nauseous the rest of the day because
what country was that from?
It was an American film.
It was an American.
Yeah, I think it's New York shot. Indie. Okay. Yeah.
God.
Sorry. Yeah, it's based on a book called. It's based on a book.
Called Bloody Horrible Time or something.
Yes. Sorry, I'm just gonna find it.
Based on that opus Liberal Guilt.
So I'm using an actual paper schedule, so I just flip through to find the notes on it.
Films about addiction are so good and so worthy, and I kind of never want to see another one. They're just always so absolutely goddamn bloody awful as well.
Mm.
I mean, with the exception of maybe like Drugstore Cowboy, which of course was the least verifiable portrayal of junkiedom I've ever seen in my life, but a good film. I just find that they just become so dispiriting. You wonder, like, after Christian F, did I ever need to see another one?
Trainspotting.
So, yeah, but those happy, sexy, hip little junkies. you know, all running around Glasgow and without their teeth falling out, with great physiques, with energy and guile, and still cracking witty jokes, not actually just curling up in a fetal position in a gutter and
there was a fair
with
amount
their
of that,
teeth dropping out of their heads and beating people over the fucking head with a 4x2 to try and get another bit of. It's like, I like train spotting, but it's the Scooby Doo of heroin, you know.
And yes, heaven was what is definitely not any sort of Scooby-Doo-ness at all. It was directed by Benny and Joshua Safdie,
right?
American film, and it stars Ariel Holmes, who is a real junkie, and her co-star, who plays your boyfriend, is Caleb Landry Jones, who I adore, who is an antiviral.
Oh, yeah, sweet. Nice. Yep.
Yeah, okay. So he provided the sort of the acting chops for it, and yeah, it was grim.
Yeah, I can
but
imagine.
Great.
But when it turns up, whenever it turns up, hold me back. I'll go and see it. It just sounds amazing. But I'm just saying, as a genre, there's not much. I mean, I don't go and see sort of hostels and torture porn, but I find like true life drug stories are just tough, you know.
What's the Aronofsky one? What's that one?
That Requiem for a Dream.
Requiem for a Dream.
I loathe that.
Yeah,
that's a film
I've only managed to get halfway through that one. I've never finished.
Don't get me started on that. That's awful. It's the one thing people always forget about drugs in drug films is like there is a level at which I guess Trainspotting got right. There's a level at which they're actually kind of fun. And they always sort of forget that. It's like you're taking it because you're an addict. It's like, well, yeah, but they're actually quite fun as well. And I'd like to see a film that got that balance right of like, for quite a while, it's a lot of fun, then it's bloody awful. Rather, do we have to just cut straight to the bloody awful?
Indeed. So, Kaylee, have you got anything to add for your Vancouver report?
No, I mean it was really great. I was after the podcast, and I went to go see the short film collection that featured one by a former classmate of mine. It was great because I got to chat with him about it afterwards. The short films that were in that bundle were quite good. It just reminded me why VIF is so great, because I was standing there chatting with Kevin, and the programmer came over. One of the programmers for VIF, and so I got introduced to him, and then we ended up like having a great discussion, and it turned out that, you know, that New Zealand International Film Festival used one of his notes for one of the films we screened this year, because he wrote it for another festival that he works for. I was like, oh, small world.
The world of so, film yeah, festivals so is a very I've, small world, yeah.
Judge Palmer, you've been on the bench how long?
42 years.
Just lost your wife?
Tough day.
You're tired, in the dark, visibility poor. Do you remember hitting the victim?
I'm going to impale your father on a first-degree murder charge, and you get a front row seat.
So tell me what happened.
This was an accident, period. Any decent lawyer can argue this easily. And by decent, I mean honest.
We both knew he didn't intentionally hit him, right? But if we can gain sympathy from the jury, they'll never convict you.
I sat on the bench in that courtroom for 42 years. The people in this community trust me. They trust the law. I'd rather die in prison than be remembered like that.
Robert Downey Jr., Robert Duvall, in small town Indiana.
Absolute goddamn cast to die for, isn't it?
Yeah.
Vera Farmiga suddenly turns up.
Vincent D'Onofrio.
Is that how you pronounce it?
I don't know.
Yeah. D'Onofrio. I love that. Yeah. And
yes, you think it'd be great.
Yeah. So you got to go, how did they all turn up in that film?
Oh, because Robert Downey Jr. decided he wanted to do a drama.
Right.
And
he's obviously down there as co-producer with his missus, his wife.
And so then what happens is money starts to flock
right
to these projects. And
so there's Duvall going, actually, I wouldn't mind being the bad guy in the next Iron Man, because then I could finally retire. Okay.
I'll
do this thing for the kid.
I don't think there's any sign of him retiring anytime soon.
Duvall is wonderful in it. And Downey Jr. I find him an irritating chipmunk of an actor, but he's good at what he does.
Well, this is true. So, Kaylee, you saw this more recently than the other two of us. Do you want to give us a little bit of a rundown about the plot?
Yes. So, Robert Downey Jr. plays a big city lawyer based in Chicago. So, yay, I got to go back to Chicago for like 5 seconds in the opening credits. His mother passes away, has to go back to his childhood home. He does not get along with his father. But while he is home, his father gets into a bit of a scrape of trouble. And Robert Downey Jr. ends up having to represent him. And it is his toughest case to date. Father issues, blah.
Very, very much father and son issues involved in this. In fact, for all of the thousands of words that have been written about Gone Girl and feminism and misogyny and screen portrayals of women, there's been not one single word written about how appallingly treated in a narrative sense the women in The Judge are. They're either, Madonnas or whores.
Yeah.
Or children.
There were so many things that irritated me about that film that I actually forgot to be irritated about the fact that the women in it are nothing except ex or potential sex. I mean, there's the potential sex partner woman, and there's there's the departed mother woman, and who else was there?
Oh, and the bitch wife, to be ex-wife.
Yeah. Yeah, the about to be ex-wife who broke Robert Downey Jr.'s heart by sleeping with somebody else.
But the reason why it's almost not worth mentioning is because that's actually Hollywood standard.
Yeah.
Standard lazy portrayal, and it's much more interested, like so many Hollywood films are, in about the relationship between men. So
it's one thing that struck me. I mean, I get asked to help people work on films quite a bit. I mean, and I've got this little rule of thumb which I don't actually strictly stick to, but it's what I always tell writers is like, if I see the word typical anywhere in the screenplay, then I won't do it. Because it just means to me that you haven't thought about it and you haven't worked hard enough, because at the level at which you're writing characters or even locations, there's no such thing as typical. There are no typical single mothers. There are no typical Chicago lawyers. There are no typical Newtown fathers. Like, everyone is actually an individual, and you've got to write them well enough so that they are atypical, beyond typicality. And to me, The Judge was like, I imagine that screenplay would have been full of the word typical. He's a typical retired judge. He's a typical Chicago lawyer.
Yeah, and they do, and there is an element of trying to get under their skin, but a very token. It's a token effort to try and understand these people as real people. I thought it was quite well plotted in a kind of John Grisham sort of way.
Oh, yeah, the structure and plot was impeccable. In a very John Grisham with daddy issues kind of way. Yeah.
And you know, it's quite well constructed in the sense that courtroom dramas you've got to be a pretty bad director, I reckon, to bugger up a courtroom drama. Because
when you've got Billy Bob Thornton on the other side of the table to play with, I mean, you can't really go
of A-League. Yeah,
yeah. Speaking of somebody who can just walk in and actually make your bad film look good, you know, Exhibit A, Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah. There's there were things to admire about it, but there were things also that I found really surprisingly irritating about it. I thought it was really badly photographed. Mm-hmm. Like, that it would, within a scene, it would change from a sort of slightly handheld, wobbly look to a sort of rigid position, or it would get some film grain, an overexposed sort of film grain in it periodically. And I was thinking, it's like somebody hadn't really decided what the look of this thing was going to be. And then I saw it's shot by Janusz Kaminski, who shoots Spielberg, right? So
who's one of the great cinematographers of the bloody era. I didn't stick around long enough to spot that.
Right, Holly Hunter's partner. Yeah. And so
you are a font of knowledge, Daniel. Well, I certainly didn't know that.
It's 44 minutes into the show. If people are still listening, they should get something for it.
That was the plastic toy in the bottom of the Weet-Bix, kids.
So, but it seemed to me that there was no consistency of sort of thought about how this thing was going to actually look. You know, it had the courtroom stuff looked so different to the rest of it. You know,
I think for me the most aggravating thing about it was that it was so tiresomely competent. Mm. It was beautifully acted, and I mean, I wasn't jarred by the cinematography, but I'm prepared to go back and have a look at it not the whole bloody thing.
No, you're not.
But I'll go and sit through 20 minutes of the middle of it just to form an opinion on what Dan just said about the cinematography. I mean, it looked stylish and expensive, and it was obviously cast with very, very stylish and expensive actors, and it was all the quality was there, but it's just like no sense at all that the director knew the people he was talking about, or that it was ever trying to be anything other than just cookie-cutter quality movie.
Yeah.
There was something nakedly ambitious about it, but there was nothing, there's no soul in it.
Kaylee, what irritated you about it?
Oh, what didn't irritate me about this? I felt it was a story that was sloppily told. I felt like it was a assembly cut rather than a tight cut. I was sitting there looking at things that could have been chopped out because I didn't care about it. And see, the funny thing is like because I watched The Judge and then Gone Girl today, it's like that's why I appreciated David Fincher's beginning credits so much, because in The Judge it's like on and on and on and all these shots of where you are and he's driving from this place to another and like, oh my god, look, there's cornfields and this and this. And I'm like, David Fincher did that in these really snappy, really great opening credits where you're like, okay, cool, we're in the suburbs, I know where we are. Like, I don't need these huge sweeping shots. This is not important to the story. Yes, I know there are cornfields in Illinois. Like, who doesn't? And it was just so long and so, like, just so sloppy. Basic. I didn't feel like there's any depth to it.
Who's the director? What's he done before?
Let me look it up.
I have it.
He was no one whose name jumped out and hit me between the eyes, so I kind of... But there was something he'd done where I kind of went, oh, yeah, that wasn't awful.
He directed Shanghai Nights, Wedding Crashers.
Oh, that's right. No, he's done. So he's
So we're really talking about class.
He's like the guy that made Wedding Crashers. I mean, Wedding Crashers is a fine film of its type.
Ilk, yeah.
But geez, it ain't courtroom drama. It probably should have been courtroom drama for, you know, obviously stupefaction and rape. But it wasn't a courtroom drama.
I want to just have a quick word about Downey Jr., who I have often enjoyed. In fact, more often than not enjoyed on screen. I think that, you know, he justifiably earns the huge money for the Iron Man franchise. He's turned, almost single-handedly turned those films into real first-class entertainment.
He so owns that character. It's impossible to imagine anyone else playing that character.
Which, if you go back to films like Chaplin and things like that, you know how good he can be. The first of the Sherlock Holmes films, he was very entertaining.
The first one was a good film, and he was good in it.
He
just blazes with intelligence. I find him an anxious little creep, but he does blaze with intelligence.
But this performance was, it seemed to me, Downey Jr. by numbers. Downey Jr. doing the stuff that Downey Jr. knows audiences will eat up. It was an indulgent performance. And whenever he was on screen alongside real actors doing real acting, like Duval, like the whole of the first sort of 10-15 minutes, it's Downey Jr. on his own in Chicago and he's wisecracking his way through various bits and pieces, and then he gets to Indiana and D'Onofrio turns up and you think, oh, we're in the presence of that's a real actor doing some real acting over there. And then Duval turns up and Duval, we were talking about 10 bucks or a six pack for Oscar predictions. I would love to see Duval pick up a Best Supporting
for this.
Yeah. I thought it was a fantastic performance. I thought it was.
The only moments in the film that it came even close to impressing me were a couple of, and it basically Duval solo. The little glance through the doorway as he touched the coffin, that got me. But, you know, I lost my mother 2 years ago, so that sort of stuff's going to get me. Yeah. But he does it. He did that with real
dignity.
He's a very dignified actor, and he didn't sacrifice his dignity in this at all.
Not at all. And the best scene in the film is the bathroom scene, which I've never seen done in a Hollywood, that sort of lack of dignity done in a Hollywood big budget, big star movie like this. And I thought that
There's no one to compare Robert Duvall. He's actually got a lock on all of those roles now, isn't he? I mean, Gene Hackman obviously isn't working anymore. I don't know who is working of that age who's got anything like, it's just him and Morgan Freeman now, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, and Duvall is still a heavyweight.
Yeah, he's still a heavyweight. He's not just got all his faculties, he's got a raw power about him now. Actually, you've got a Maori TV, it's either Saturday or Sunday night this weekend, they're playing The Apostle, which he also wrote also wrote and directed, with Farrah Fawcett in her last ever role, and June Carter Cash, Johnny Cash's wife, all in the Apostle. So if we can digress into TV reviewing for a second, if you want to see a great film on Sunday night, The Apostle's on Maori TV, and that's Robert Duvall at his absolute finest in a script that he wrote himself.
The Judge, it's as we know, it's doing decent business, but it's doing it on the back of an international marketing campaign and big star.
But it's also probably getting people in to see a drama who probably don't see that many. I hate to sound like a snob, but the Downey Jr. name will be getting people. I mean, when was the last time a drama turned up at the multiplex?
Yeah, and it doesn't have the Grisham name to capitalize
on. It's not a comedy drama. It's not a thriller drama. It's an actual drama. And that is basically an art house genre these days.
Kaylee, do you have two words for the judge?
My two words for the judge are tepid nachos.
I knew you were going to say that. That's good.
And Graham, do you have two words?
Yeah, but one of them you can't say on this podcast. So.
You've said, you have given us the explicit rating already, so I say just don't worry about it.
Did I?
Yeah.
What did I? God, see, I'm sorry. How did I get through 8 years of national radio without swearing once? So come on here and it all comes out. Underwritten.
Okay, underwritten is a good one. I was going to go somewhere there, but I want to say something to do with guilty, but I can only do it with three words. Guilty is charged.
I was gonna say it looks like a good film if you've never actually seen a good film.
New Zealand's only Oscar-accredited short film festival, Show Me Shorts, last night announced the program for the event that will be touring the country in November. The festival is emphasizing the international component this year, with shorts featuring Hollywood stars Amanda Seyfried and Oscar-nominated Sally Hawkins. The festival website will have the full program by the end of the week, but in the meantime, you can download a PDF of the print program and then decide whether you are going to see Show Me Shorts in Alexandria, Auckland, Christchurch, Sneeden, Hamilton, Havelock North, Matakana, New Plymouth, Oamaru, Palmerston North, Parapara-Umu, Stewart Island, Tauranga, Timaru, Wellington, or Whitianga.
Stewart Island has a cinema. That's the one thing that's probably prevented me from moving there, was I didn't think there was a cinema, and now there is.
That's my takeout from today's show. Definitely, I didn't know Stewart Island had a cinema, and I've been to the famous one in Wanaka. I've been to that. That's amazing.
Mm.
Have you been to the one in Wanaka?
Yeah, I have.
Where the guy comes out with, like, basically brews his own beer and sells it to you, but also makes his own chocolate chip cookies and comes out and flogs them at half time. He's just the best.
I think it's one of New Zealand's – it's one of the things I love about New Zealand. There are wonderful independent cinemas all over the place. I did not know there was one in Stewart Island. Mm. Also, interesting takeout from this is that as the Show Me Shorts Festival grows – it was a few years ago that it opened itself up to international entries, and now it's sort of taking those international entries and actually using those as the selling point rather than the New Zealand work. Which,
if you want to get bums on seats, then it probably helps to say, hey, there's a film with Amanda Seyfried in it.
Yeah, well,
sad but true, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was Oscar accredited now.
Yeah,
that's really impressive.
If you win the grand prize, then you automatically go through to consideration for the short films at the Oscars. It is the New Zealand pathway.
Wow. Warner Brothers chief executive Kevin Sugihara announced further details of their upcoming slate of releases, including titles and stars for their previously untitled DC Comics movies through to 2020. Are you ready? These include two Justice League of America movies to be directed by Zack Snyder, a Wonder Woman starring Gal Gadot, Ezra Miller in The Flash, and Aquaman starring Game of Thrones' Jason Momoa. Also, now we have our Game of Thrones.
We've mentioned Game of Thrones, which does wonders for our search engine optimization. So
if we say Game of Thrones, people find us
The more often we say it, the better, pretty much. It's like, we did this, when I was preparing to launch the show, I had a look at the top 30 Australian film and television podcasts, and half of them were Game of Thrones podcasts.
My joy over the fact that I'm going to see Ezra Miller in anything, even if it's The Flash, because I love Ezra Miller. I think that kid is just burning with talent. I think
he's the we need to talk about Kevin.
He's Kevin
guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he was Kevin, and he turned up in a really nice little rom-com or rom-dram a couple of months after Kevin. It was like he was sort of the gay best mate to the woman who was to the girl who was having the affair with the quarterback or something. I forget what it was called, but he was dynamite in that as well. So even if I was going to say, the fact that Ezra Miller's in another film almost alleviates my unhappiness of the fact that Zack Snyder's still working, because I think he's dreadful.
I have to say that the good news about this is that Zack Snyder is going to be so busy he won't be able to make anything else except these.
Yeah, true. But he's just Speaking of Scooby-Doo, I mean, there's someone who really should just be directing cartoons because he's just got no sense of people at all. He just animates now. I really don't dislike his directing intensely. But he's quick and he brings stuff in on budget, and he's now got enough names on his CV to be a film by the guy that made that last film that you spent $20 seeing. But I think he's an appalling director.
And there's more. Oh, there's more. They also announced three new films set in the world of Harry Potter and three new Lego movies, including Will Arnett as Lego Batman. And I rewatched the Lego movie the other day, and it's still so great.
I love that film. I know. God, that's like a spaceship. My partner HBO honestly couldn't work out for like weeks afterwards. Whenever anything good happened, I would just go, spaceship! And I'm going, I'm 47 years old, you know? Spaceship! Oh, that was fantastic. Anyway, sorry.
HBO set audience hearts aflutter with an announcement of their own today. In 2015, they intend to break away from the cable channels and offer their online HBO Go service to people without a cable subscription. Oh my God!
Which means that if you are one of those people who in New Zealand who basically cheats and is able to get Netflix from internationally, you will be able to do the same with HBO, which means we can get another Game of Thrones reference in to the show because, of course, that will allow us to watch Game of Thrones at the same time as everybody else in the world.
So
we should just have an HBO report. Built in starting 2015.
Yeah, we should. Well, absolutely. Yeah. This is a podcast about movies and other cool stuff, and it does allow us to actually talk about
it. It's so fascinating looking at where all this media is going at the moment and like what actually is going to happen. This is like being around the auto industry in about 1910, going, God, are they going to have three wheels or are they going to have four? Hmm. Is it going to be steam or coal or there's newfangled petrol stuff? Well, and nobody knows what's going to happen and who's going to win. It's great.
My big concern about all of this, well, I think it's fantastic for New Zealand consumers. I think it's fantastic that these barriers are being broken down.
Anything that breaks that clammy, bloody monopoly that Sky have on so many households in this country.
Exactly. But my concern is that it just means even more of New Zealand consumers' money going straight out of the country, not intermediated by any local business. And as a result, the people that were making a contribution to funding New Zealand work, so let's say the TV networks who had to stump up some of their share of the cash to make an outrageous fortune or to make one of those Sunday dramas or what have you, if no one's watching them, There's no, I mean,
the fact that Sky New Zealand's arm is the most profitable per capita of all of the Sky businesses around the world, which it is, and it charges the most and has the greatest market penetration of any Sky service in the world, and yet it's still programmed out of Australia, and there's no New Zealand films on Sky unless you play an additional paywall to look at the Rialto channel, which is like a locally owned. It's like somebody's parked a caravan on Sky's land. Anything New Zealand made is ghettoized over there. Yeah. You won't even. I think they might have made an exception for Boy, but only because that also got Australian cinema release. And I can't think of anything. And we make some wildly commercially successful and available films here. And you go, even Sky NZ won't program Sky films because Sky won't put their hands in their pockets to employ a New Zealand programmer for Sky NZ over here.
So you're not going to mourn in any way, shape, or form the loss of those platforms. I guess anything
that damages the company that is Sky or forces them to at least acknowledge that New Zealand is not the seventh state of Australia. Would be a good thing. I loathe that company.
I think if I was working for New Zealand On Air or the New Zealand Film Commission at the moment, I would be looking at all of these circumstances. It's the Wild West now.
Mm.
And it used to be that funding an independent movie in New Zealand was a simple question of getting a broadcaster, getting New Zealand On Air, getting the Film Commission, getting some distribution. There were four phone calls that you had to make, and if one of those fell over, you didn't get to make your film. You know, it's like nowadays you've got people independently releasing their films, self-releasing. Mm-hmm. They've got online platforms. There's not enough penetration in New Zealand for those online platforms. Like, how's a New Zealand film going to get onto Netflix in the States in order to be watched by New Zealanders who are cheating their IP addresses to watch Netflix all the time? That's my worry, is that we're now going to be so focused on becoming part of the international community you know, because we want to watch True Detective and we want to watch Game of Thrones and we want to do all of that sort of stuff, that it's going to be even harder for a New Zealand piece of work to break through.
I mean, we could have exactly this conversation in pretty much every country in the world except America. I mean, I'm sure the English are probably saying the same thing about English cinema content. And God help you if you happen to be from a non-English speaking country. I mean, where's your web platform? Where's your HBO if you're, you know, say, I don't know, the Danes have a great film industry, the Welsh have a great film industry, the Swedes and the Finns, great film industries. Nobody even knows what's coming out of Russia. I guess the Asian film market is a world unto itself, as it should be.
They're making black and white noir vampire films in Iran.
I know. Proto-feminist vampire flicks in black and white, which I want to see at the Abu Dhabi Film Festival. Abu Dhabi do. I just want to...
Scooby-Doo is just a recurring theme.
How are we getting so many Scooby-Doo references into this show? I probably started it. I'm sorry. I apologise. Okay. I think what has to happen, I mean, eventually the idea that there is a broadcaster and that people pay money to a certain broadcaster and that's what comes down the pipe and flows out the front of the TV you've stuck your two-year-old in front of will become such a ridiculously outmoded and quaint idea in about another 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And everything will simply be a website.
And we will end up paying twice as much money as we do now, because it'll be $10 for HBO, $10 for Fox, $10 for Warner's, $10 for, and
if somebody can work out a way of actually securing those sites. I mean, at the moment, I mean, when piracy gets big enough, you just have to rename it the Navy. And at the moment, piracy is so big that, I mean, you can't put us all in prison. It's like, it's honestly, you may as well have, in the 80s, it's like home taping. It's, that's the extent of it now. I'm not sure on where that, I was going on with that analogy.
On that cheery note, we'll go back to Kaylee for the rest of the news.
I guess what I really meant is what's happened to the film industry is exactly what has happened to the music industry. But because film comes in bigger lumps of information, then it's still a little bit slower to take hold. Sorry, Kaylee. How's your two-year-old?
That's okay. In news that has made Dan very excited indeed, and he writes the news, so of course this is here. Christian Bale is about to sign on to the long-awaited Steve Jobs movie Jobs.
Wow.
Not sure if it's actually long-awaited, which will be based on Walter Jacobson's biography, which came out 2 years ago. The film is going to be written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by Danny Boyle, meaning it's already on the Dan Slevin's sweet spot. Now, I don't know.
Was that massive book that everyone got for Father's Day and no one read a few years ago?
I read it.
Okay, Dan read it.
I don't know if people are going to be excited about it, because so many of us were burned by the Ashton Kutcher Jobs.
Seriously, we're talking about we're going to be Sorkinated by the Sorkinator again. I've just watched the first season of The Newsroom here, and you know, for all of its faults and all of its massive irritations, it's still Sorkin.
Yeah.
And all the people talk like Sorkin, and it's gorgeous. And I love it when they talk like that, and I love it when they walk around and walk and talk and all that sort of stuff. I love if you combine that wonderful dialogue with the brilliant, intelligent, energetic direction of Danny Boyle, and about Steve Jobs.
So is Danny Boyle directing us?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, he can make any. I mean, he actually can make paint drying interesting. So,
yeah, I'm there. I'm so there. Right. I'm going to be sleeping out on the pavement, waiting for that one to open.
I mean, I'm going bald nerd dies early, but that's fine. I don't like Apple products. I think he's a sociopath.
But it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay.
What you think? Because.
So we're going to the party tonight. Cops or ghosts, your choice.
I don't want to be a ghost.
Let's be cops.
People actually think we're cops.
Please freeze!
Oh! That was awesome. Whoa, whoa, what do we have here?
Officers, this is...
Is this for real?
Damn!
I think so many interesting films we've talked about this evening, and I know time is wearing on.
It is. So I reckon we could do this real quick, couldn't we?
It's just
two words. We just jump straight to two words. Have you got anything that you're particularly interested in?
One of them is drivel, and the other one apparently I've already said. So it's just. I mean, even by the standards of bad films, this is a bad. It can't even get off its ass long enough to be a bad film.
It's very, very lazy, isn't it?
It's so lazy, so expensive. It's like somebody said, "Oh, look, there's a." I've just found an old draft of Beverly Hills Cop, and let's cut anything funny out of that. And so it's a black and white buddy comedy about two guys who find police uniforms, never even bothers to explain how he gets the police uniforms, considering they actually are authentic police uniforms with guns that fire blanks, never explains how he gets hold of these perfect Glock replicas.
Nothing is explained. Nothing.
Buys a police car on eBay, gets the badges, sticks those on. They drive around pretending to be policemen for a couple of weeks. They get in a bit of trouble with an ethnic stereotype, and then another ethnic stereotype beats them up, and they all go home.
This would appear to be the Balkan or Russian mob are the new enemy, aren't they? In Hollywood movies,
it used to be the South Africans before they obviously all turned adorable. So now you're allowed to say anything you like about the Eastern Europeans, because obviously by the time they subtitle in Eastern Europe, they'll take the references out and pretend they come from one of the other Eastern European countries. No, they're not Slovenian, Slovakian. So nobody's offended. It's great. I think that's probably how they're getting away with it. Yeah. No, not Turkistanis, Kazakhstanis. They all go, oh, that's fine, we hate them as well.
Did you see Martin Chorkash as the Russian mob guy in The Equalizer?
Yeah,
did you see that?
Yeah, God, yeah. Speaking of awful films. But Martin Chockhouse was great. He just wanted him to kill him.
Scenery just chewing.
Smack that 60-year-old B-grade actor right in his puss, you know? But no, it wasn't going to happen.
All right.
Denzel, you lazy, lazy, lazy man.
Two words for Let's Be Cops. You've had yours. Mine, I'm going to be a little bit less profane. And it's going to be First Draft.
First Draft straight to the bin. It's like somebody sat down and said, oh, we need to have two characters in our film talking about a really shit film they saw the other night. This would be the film they talked about without actually having to go through all the trouble of writing it.
What interests me is that this is a film that had terrible, terrible reviews coming out of the US.
Yeah.
Did not do spectacular box office. And I mean, obviously, it's cheap as chips to make, so it's profitable, right?
Yeah.
But the local distributor still went ahead with the putting it out, releasing it to cinemas, even though there's no stars in it. It's not like it's Adam Sandler, who you can go, oh, you know, he's a good bet in New Zealand. People always
tell you something. You saw this 6 o'clock Reddings last night, didn't you?
Yeah.
And I saw it 7 o'clock Reddings the night before. Mm. Half full house.
Oh, really?
And they were peeing themselves laughing.
Yeah, there was about 10 or 15, and they were enjoying it.
I mean, I was there on Cheap Tuesday.
Yeah.
Which I guess always probably doubles your box office, but everyone there except me was, you know, lolling, whatever that means.
God. Yeah. And so tonight on Rancho Notorious Reviews the Audiences, we are scornful. We are somewhat scornful of Wellington audiences at the moment. So you need to redeem yourselves.
Somebody votes national. You know, like, you can't hate everybody.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week, absolutely no idea what we're going to be doing. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. There's my piece of paper. If you've enjoyed this episode, you know, and you're still with us, you can subscribe at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you will find ways to communicate with us. You can email us from there, or you can make a comment on the site.
Spice up!
You can follow up. You can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word, where we will be tweeting incessantly about things we think are interesting. And you can interact with us on Letterboxd too. Our username is Rancho Notorious.
The show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 has been executive produced by Robert Cato, Random Films, Claire Quiray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Of course, that's the Lost Plantronics version, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to play you out with some more music from The Judge. This is somebody called L'Orchestre Cinématique and a song called Hills to Climb. Special thanks to my partner Karen, who's listening in the other room and who makes sure that everyone who visits here at Rancho Notorious is well fed and well looked after. Thanks very much to Graham here in Wellington. Thanks to Kaylee in Canada. Thanks to you all for listening. That's good evening from me, Dan Slevin.
Good night from me, Kaylee.
And good night from me, and thank you very much, the pair of you.
Built these walls of stone, and then they crumble back today. We spin these tales of love out of trust and hope and prayer. Underneath our wounds, where our demons have their home, the truth can be exposed. There's a strength in letting go.